right? It's also a scheme to make structural optimizations extremely efficient. This seems to be nearly the only way to really optimize complex systems. Optimization strategies, the best what chemists use today, are basically based on a harmonic approximation of the total energy surface. If you look for the next minimum or extremum or whatever, you can easily see that this goes bananas when you have many, many almost degenerate minimum, right? You don't come over the barriers, right? And that's exactly where people get stuck, and that's where Carpinero helps out, because in that case, you just do one thing, you heat the thing up to a certain temperature, let it go for a while until you see it's no more qualitatively changing, then you cool quench to zero.
I think that the microphone is probably not picking up.
Yeah, probably you should
put the sound.
Okay.
So we recording. Can hear you, but the recording is not working.
What about this?
They're recording something, okay.
Yeah.
Now we know why there were little columns,
yeah.
Rain columns going on.
Okay. So,
never say whatever you like, though.
Everything? Are you sure? Okay. Okay. Another way is it can handle large base sets efficiently. And that was especially important for schemes like the pseudopotential approach, where you may have something like 10,000 or more variational degrees of freedom in your calculation. Okay. The principle of it is very easily shown. You just solve, I mean, that's basically from classical dynamics. I will iterate on that a little more. So you calculate the Newton's equations of motion, mass times acceleration of the atomic positions equal to the force, and the force is, of course, the total energy derivative with a negative sign. Okay, now this is what you do in classical MD, and now if you do it with density function theory, there's a psi standing in there, a wave function, right? And this wave function is hard to get because you need that wave function for every set of atomic positions. So that, I mean, if you just think it, that at that time, electronic structure calculations were one of the few things where you really spend a lot of computer time on. Doing that something like 40,000 times in a row was sort of difficult to imagine, right? Now that was, Carpinello suggested a very nice trick around. They just wrote down another classical equation of motion for your wave functions, right? And then they do classical MD on this, and they completely avoid the self-consistency iteration. So they essentially have one self-consistency iteration per time step for the atoms. And that works extremely beautifully, and I will describe that in a little more detail now.
The M psi chosen?
The M psi? That's a magic number, right? So basically you have to know the frequency spectrum of your system, and I will just say a little more about it. So essentially there are two considerations that tell you in what range you can choose it, right? If you choose it, of course you would like to choose it as small as possible, because then it doesn't affect your motion. Okay. Then you pay a price because you need very many iterations, because if your mass is too small and your time step is too large, the dynamics is unstable, right?
Also, if you could handle the real mass, then you would make the real dynamics, right? I mean,
right.
If you could afford 1/1836, then you wouldn't make this. Maybe you make some Hamiltonian dynamics, which is the
real. Right.
Monday, then you can take like 100-200 times the real one.
But since the dynamics is fictitious, doesn't it make more sense to do Langevin dynamics? Why?
No, because...
What you want is to get to the ground state, no?
No, you want to oscillate around the ground state.
Why?
Now you want to be in the ground state.
On average, your process effort.
Now, the point is with Langevin, you introduce noise. This noise propagates into the dynamics here. It messes up everything. The thing is, one of the ideas of Carpinello, do everything smooth, integrate everything. As soon as you have the smallest noise in your calculation, the whole thing blows apart. Because your noise is sort of propagated. I mean, it's propagated in all the systems that you have, right? So
well,
introduce high frequency.
No noise, but just damping.
Oh, you can put damping. Yeah, we do that. Yeah, if you want to get the ground state, you put damping. But if you want to do dynamics, you just put as much damping as you have to put, right? As little as possible. Okay, maybe we come to that a little later, right?
Okay.
But I think the answer is you always have a problem because you want to keep two systems at different temperatures. You want to keep the electrons very cold, close to the ground state, which is the von instantaneous von Oppenheimer surface. And you want to keep the ions at the temperature they deserve to because they move. Now, this is not stable, but the best way to keep the electrons around von Oppenheimer at low temperature while the ions move seems to be this one. Also, this conserves energy, which Lenz does not take.
Right. Now, the important bit, if you put a friction here, you have to think of atoms as a quasi-particle, right? It's a strange kind of quasi-particle because it's essentially a nucleus in an electron gas. So it's sort of surrounded like a polariton, and polariton is an electron surrounded by a polarization cloud of the atoms. Here you have an atom which polarizes your electron gas, makes the shell structure. So this is a coupled system. So if you put a friction here, you also implicitly put a friction here, which messes up your dynamics, right? That's why you want the friction here to be as small as possible. You have to put some friction, but we have now, I've just written a paper where it shows you how to do that basically with almost minimum effort, and they're making sure that if you affect the dynamics here, basically the way you affect the dynamics here, you correct in here, right? So, but this is now the high art of doing ab initio MD simulation, so I don't want to get into that much detail.
So in the whole, the key thing is conservation, try to conserve energy
right.
in a reasonable way, and that's right. Why the damping is a bad idea.
Yes, right.
Okay. You didn't mention updates, that you, after a couple of hundred steps, you do an almost consistency.
We don't do that anymore. No. Okay, the thing is, we're starting now at the end. I mean, this is now really the tricky bits about ab initio MD, right? So the point is maybe, we can do it here if you wish. I mean, there's nothing wrong with it. Okay, so what do we do today? If you do a simulation here, okay, of course there are other parts written here. For example, we have a thermostat. A thermostat, I mean, the best thing to do is a Noether thermostat who showed that basically by adding a single dynamical variable in the proper way, this you introduce an additional variable into your dynamical equations. This variable tunes a friction. This friction can be positive and negative, and the dynamics of the variable is coupled to the kinetic energy of the system, right? So this is sort of a feedback loop which makes sure that the fluctuations of the total energy or the kinetic energy exactly reproduce the canonical ensemble, right? So that's how we do finite temperature simulations, right? The time scales are incorrect, but your ensemble is correct, right? Okay, now we have this thing. Now what do we do with this? We've just seen that, I mean, quenching is a terrible thing, right? I mean, that's what people did in the first time. So what do you do? I mean, what now happens if you have now two coupled equations of motion, right? The coupling is rather small because the frequency spectra are separated, right? So this is going on the Fonon frequencies, and we make sure that this is going on a much higher frequency, which works nicely if you have a semiconductor because your smallest frequency of the electron system is determined by the band gap. And if you have a metal, you have a problem. Right? Now I think this problem is not as severe as what we thought because we understand now better what the problem is and we can avoid that. So it's basically a principle problem. So if you want to make a proof, you're in trouble. But if you want to do it in practice, I don't think it's a big issue anymore. Okay, so what do you do with this? Now still they are coupled, even though slightly. At some point, this is running at a high temperature. At some point, these two will equilibrate, right? So this one will heat up. And as you know, when that is heated up, it's normally in the ground state. That means your density function total energy is garbage. Everything that you get is nonsense. So this thing you have to keep at the smallest temperature possible. Now what does smallest temperature mean? Smallest temperature does not mean that the wave function shouldn't change, because otherwise the nuclei would happily vibrate about the electrons, right? What really happens is, the thing is, okay, I'm going too far. So you have a total energy surface, right? So you want, basically, when the atoms move, right, the electrons, the wave function at least have to follow to reproduce the instantaneous wave function in each time step, right? Okay, that requires a certain motion of the wave functions when the atoms are moving, even when the wave functions are at zero temperature. So you can divide your dynamics into two pieces. One piece is the so-called von Oppenheimer dynamics, where the wave functions actually are always in the instantaneous ground state when the atoms are moving. The second part is sort of a free motion. Even though you might keep the atomic position frozen, you can introduce temperature into the electronic systems, into the wave functions, and they will happily vibrate, right? This is the free motion. And the free motion, that corresponds to deviations from the Born-Oppenheimer surface, and that you want to kill out, right? So what we do right now, we put a second thermostat, which is coupled not only to the kinetic energy in the wave functions, but also the kinetic energy in the atoms. Because what we do is we estimate from the atomic positions how much kinetic energy I need in the wave function dynamics. And if I go above that value, then I have a thermostat that puts a friction into this system at the same time puts an opposite friction on this one. So the energy is just pumped from here to there. And you're not losing energy in this one. The whole thing is completely energy conserving. It does it up after a certain while. And surprisingly, there's a certain period it goes. Then this kinetic energy is again below the target. And you just switch the thing off without perturbing the system at all and runs for a long time until you need to quench again. So quenching to the ground state is awful because then your wave function is still stand, your atoms are moving. So the first thing that happens is the atoms are slowed down because the electrons have to start moving first until they work synchronously, right? So in the first instance, the atoms now feel basically they're moving away from the ideal position relative to the electrons and they're being slowed down, right? So, and secondly, you're accelerating in a very awkward fashion, very quickly, the wave functions, which introduces free vibrations of the wave functions, right? So first you're affecting your atomic dynamics in an awful way, and secondly, you're messing up your electrons. So once you do this quenching down, you introduce a problem right from the start again, right? So there are much more clever ways to deal with this problem, but that, I think that's more or less under control. Does that give you a flavor of how we do
one
this?
One question. Yeah? All this quenching didn't exist in the very original version, I think, and yet they were reasonably getting components of silicon or stuff like that. What is the explanation? They were cheating?
No, the simulation time was...
In silicon... Now concerns the need of having long simulation times for calculating averages of some variables. But for some instantaneous motion, you wouldn't have the time to build up the...
I mean, in silicon, everything works, and you can happily do a simulation in silicon about 5 picoseconds. It would just run smoothly. You wouldn't see a thing, right?
Yeah,
so they were just smart starting with exactly the right material. As soon as you go away from silicon, magically, you run into trouble with anything, right? So that was just luck. All the calculations that I have seen had actually the early calculation had the quenching in. Not everybody talked about it, I think. Right. So every 200 time steps, approximately, they just quench the thing down.
As Bernard was saying, you're calculating your self-consistency nicely.
Peter, I've been thinking a little bit about this, what it is the car parallel actually does. And it seems that what it buys you is, like you said, the ensemble comes out, the ensemble average correctly and the time scales are incorrect. But if that's really true, does that mean if I make the mass of the electrons equal to the mass of the nuclei, for example, I will still get the correct ensemble?
No.
You had said that I didn't simply...
The ensemble you always get correct. I mean, the thing is...
That's what I thought you said. So if I make that mass as big as a...
No, this is the wrong dynamics. It's not the inhomogeneous, the time-dependent Schrödinger equation. I'll come to that.
Yeah, but my question is simply, when the mass of the electrons is very small, right, then I'll get the right answer.
Yeah, then you end the Born Oppenheimer circuit.
The mass of the electron is small but not zero, where you say, I don't solve it, will still have it correctly. Even though the time scales will be off. My ensemble averages over the nuclear.
Sorry, I was referring to a different point altogether. This thing is something, okay. Let me just repeat what I meant to say, and maybe I didn't say it clearly. I was talking about the thermostat, right? So the thermostat is like coupling your system to a bath, a heat bath, right? Now, a heat bath thermodynamically is defined by the temperature, right? A heat bath in reality is defined by the temperature and its frequency spectrum and the couplings from your system to the heat bath, right? Okay, we get the temperature all right, so we get the right ensemble averages in this dynamics, independent of wave functions, right? But we get the time scales of this coupling to the environment incorrect, which is usually not a big problem, because as you go to larger and larger systems, as we know, the coupling will be small, and you just have to wait long enough until the temperature is transferred, and then you don't, I mean, the time scale of the temperature transfer is so slow that you're usually not interested in it, because it's, in any case, I mean, let's say, except in Carpinello simulations, in the time scale that is much longer than the atomic, the Fonon frequencies, right? So it's actually not a big issue, because the physical timescales of this dynamics are just in different range. That was the thermostat, right? Now here, you're making an error, right? And hopefully a small one, okay? You try to control this. It's like a convergence parameter. You can crank up your plane wave cutoff, or you can reduce this mass. And you just do that and find out when your simulation is accurate, right? Or when it converges, right? One point to note is here, in general about classical MD simulations, these simulations are chaotic systems with almost no exclusion. So therefore, the emphasis when you look at dynamics is practically never the real dynamics. So you'd never want to really try to start up with the wave function and try to change your boundary conditions and see how long that goes. It goes exactly right until you hit the next atom front exactly on the front, and then one trajectory will go left, the other one will go right. So it never goes right, but basically this accuracy of your dynamics stops exactly at about one or two Fonon frequencies. And then the only thing that you can talk about is statistics, right? So the time, the correlations of your true dynamics, if you want to really be precise, have a precise dynamics, has a very short time scale where it's actually correct, right? But the qualitative things, if you want to calculate Fonon frequencies, they don't depend on the individual trajectory, but on ensembles of trajectories. And there, the error actually doesn't matter. This error, right? Okay.
So let me make sure I understand. The upper limit on the mass of the fictitious mass of the electrons is, you know, considerably less than the mass of the nuclei, because otherwise the fluctuations in the electronic part,
right,
start destroying even your ensemble average for your
photons. Right, right. The upper scale is actually the frequency, the separation of the time scales in these two systems, right? If these frequency spectrums overlap, you have thermal coupling and you're done. So you try to have this large enough so that they don't, small enough that they don't overlap, but large enough that you can still iterate it and get some simulation time. Okay? Any other question? Good. So I think we discussed almost all that. I just wanted to take you by the hand, and maybe for those that are not familiar, just tell you a bit about how it's done and so on. It may be useful. Okay, let's go to first classical MD. So we forget about wave functions. We start from a total energy function that depends only on the atomic positions. And usually this is written as a pair potential, for example, for van der Waals interaction, then you have a bond length interaction, you have angle forces, and so on, right? So you write down for every set of potential, of positions, you can write down your total energy. Then you take write the Newton's equations of motion, mass times velocity is equal to force, minus the derivative of the total energy functional. then you discretize that. So how do you do that? You replace the second derivative by the differential quotient, right? Which is this object, right? So you select the time step delta, and you have now three different time, the positions of three different time slices connected. You just resolve that for the next time step, because that's what you want to know, knowing the rest of the trajectory. You resolve it, you get here the next time step as a function of the two previous time steps plus the fourth calculated for the current time step, right? So all that you can calculate, and then you just, okay, this is a shorthand notation that I will use in the following, so just keep the sign here, because essentially you keep three samples of your atomic positions, and then you just reshuffle the positions into the old arrays, right? Okay, so that's the Rayleigh algorithm. There are different algorithms to integrate the equations of motion. The Rayleigh algorithm is the one that is most stable. So if you want to do large time steps relative to your atomic motion, the Rayleigh is the thing to do. If you have a very fine grid, there are better iteration schemes, but we need stability. We want to make sure if you have spent a week of simulation time that doesn't go bananas immediately, right? So stability is more important than accuracy in this case. Good. Just to say a little bit about the Rayleigh algorithm. This is the harmonic oscillator, just to show you the stability limit. The Rayleigh algorithm is extremely stable, right? So this is now simply one-dimensional harmonic oscillator. This is the time scale. This is the amplitude, right? This is exactly integrated, right? So delta divided by the period of the oscillation is zero. This is exact integration. You can solve it analytically, right? You can also solve it analytically when you discretize it, right? And then you get this one for where the time step is about a tenth of the period. No, 0.2, yeah, a tenth. Here it's 0.2. And you see now it's getting awkward. You have the zigzag lines. Now just believe me, you can, this is just because I have a linear interpolation between the two points. If I would just take the points and put a cosinus function through it, it would be a cosinus function. There's basically no difference, and I'll show you in a minute what the difference is. This is, the time step is one-third of the oscillation period. Just imagine what that means, right? Three times, and you go through a period. It's still stable, but that is the stability limit. If you go a bit higher, smaller, your time, if you make your time step a little bit larger than that, you get this exponential divergence, right? So when you hit this point, your simulation is done, right? So you have to make sure that you stay sufficiently far away from this point, and this essentially is very sensitive for the electrons, which is the fastest frequency in your system. Now, let's look at the other point. You want to know, this is stability. How accurate are you? Now, you can also do that if you discretize the harmonic oscillator, and then you calculate the deviation from the original frequency. There should be an omega zero, right? So this is the actual frequency rescaled relative to the frequency of the exact solution, right? And this is now the time step, again in a unit relative to the eigenfrequency of the harmonic oscillator, right? So it simply means here, when the time step is zero, we do analytic exact integration. If we go here, here we hit the stability limit, so that is exactly this point, right? So we hit here. You see, the frequency is rather accurate here at low frequency. The largest error that you make is about 1.5 or p half or something, right? Then the thing blows up. Now, what time step would you want to choose? You want, of course, for the atoms at least, you want to have the frequencies accurate, let's say, to a percent. Which means...
Delta T?
Sorry?
What is delta omega?
The delta? Delta times omega, that should be zero.
Oh, delta times omega.
Delta times omega zero, right? So if you basically, it means that if you make your time step about a tenth of your oscillation period, you are introducing errors smaller than a percent in your frequencies, right? So that's important to watch out, right? So which also tells us that since we usually stay in that regime, that the integration of the equation of motion is not a problem when we do calculate phonons. Good. Right. Okay. Now let's go to electron dynamics. They can also tell me if I'm going too slow, right? So if you want to do now ab initio molecular dynamics, you need the forces, so you need the wave function, instantaneous ground state. The point is, you can do, basically the electrons are so light that the time scales of the motion decouple, and the electron dynamics in most cases does not matter. And we just do the same thing. Since we are keeping only the information of the ground state at every point of atomic positions, we don't study wave function dynamics. We don't care about it, right? Because it's decoupled from the atomic motion, at least not in Carpanello. There are questions whether the wave function dynamics is extremely interesting in certain chemical reactions. People spend a lifetime on it. We're not studying that right now. Yeah? Okay. The wave function, when you move the atoms, the wave function simply have to adapt to adiabatically to the changing atomic positions. So we need basically the Born-Oppenheimer surface, which is the total energy functional, which you obtain by fixing all the atomic positions, quenching your electrons to the ground state. And this total energy surface gives you the forces on the atoms which dictate the atomic dynamics. So a simple approach, which is a little dull, but easy to understand, is the following. So you do pick a set of atomic positions, you do a self-consistent calculation, you calculate the forces, you do one Verley step, and you repeat the thing from the beginning, right? So if you have a big computer, you can do also that. If you want to do it in a different way, you do it the Carpanello way. And in the Carpanello way, we exploit basically that we're not interested in wave function dynamics or electron dynamics. So naively, one would use for wave functions in the time-dependent Schrödinger equation. We're not interested in the dynamics, so we can replace this part, the time derivative, with something else. So we just basically replace the first derivative with the second derivative, right? Okay. This change does not matter because we're not interested in electron dynamics. And then you get these equations of motion. That's actually what we use. So I've written that down previously, the atomic equations of motion. This is the equation of motion for the wave functions. There's one thing to be considered. We still need to worry about a constraint. Because of the Pauli principle, the one particle wave function must be orthogonal. And you introduce that by a constraint. So this is the force of constraint. And here you have Lagrange multipliers, which, when you converge, are identical to your Hamilton matrix elements between the wave functions that you're using. Okay, so that's what we do, and we cast the whole thing into a fictitious Lagrangian. That's the reason why this method is called a fictitious Lagrangian approach. So we just introduce a Lagrangian, which depends on the velocities of the atoms, the velocities of the wave functions, and the positions of the atoms and the wave functions. In addition, I've added here the constraint that the wave functions are pairwise orthogonal and normalized. And lambda are just the Lagrange parameters. Yes?
Wouldn't it be an advantage to propagate the time-dependent Coase-Hamilton equation? Because then the orthogonality would be automatically satisfied.
Yes, that is true. The trouble is that you're not stable. This equation of motion that's exactly the problem. First order equations are even worse than
forced to use the real electron mass in this case.
If you just want to have the orthogonality, you can also do it this way. And Uzi Landmann is doing it that way. It's possible. There's nothing wrong with it. It's just that you do something else. You never get into the ground state, right? How do you get into the ground state if you do this? I mean, you do dynamics. At some point, you have introduced errors, and you end up, you don't know where. If you're here and you're doing this dynamics, we know, for example, put a tiny perturbation, a small friction, and we end up in the ground state, right? So this thing is stable, whereas this one is sort of unstable. And first-order differential equations are anyway a big mess, right? Second-order differential equations are much more harmless because they sort of already have probably kind of Runge-Kutta built in, right? So actually, this one is not much easier to integrate than this one. It's worse. Okay. Unfortunately, I can't really tell you, I mean, what goes exactly bananas. I thought about it once, but I don't have it present anymore. But in practice, I mean, you can do it, it's just expensive because you have to control all your errors.
So it's right? An empirical finding that stability
is strong. Yes, I would say so.
But how can you use the first of the two equations with a mass different than the electronic, the true electronic?
Just use a fictitious H bar.
There's no mass in the first order differential equation.
No viscosity.
No, so what do you do? You have to put a fictitious H bar.
You rescale your time scale, right? So you say T is equal to 10 times your physical time, and then you get here a factor, and that effectively changes your H bar. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. It works. It doesn't give you the physical wave function dynamics, of course, right? So you're not doing time-dependent DFT or something, but you can at least integrate it.
Peter, how do you find the occupation numbers?
The occupation numbers? Depends. Either you know them, for example, for silicon, I can just tell you,
okay.
Or you have an additional dynamics for your wave functions. There are different ways.
You should know the spectrum.
You should know the eigenvalues, yes. So you have to work a little more. I mean, this is, doing dynamical occupation is still a thing that is in flux. There are many solutions, some are definitely working, but they are sort of involving additional iteration loops, which I don't want to do. There are other ways that are sort of okay, but cumbersome, and other schemes that are practically okay, but theoretically they have problems and so on. So I think we're now converging. I mean, this thing will soon be under control.
Could you explain these indices to the lambda?
Oh yeah. The lambda, okay, what is this? This is the band index of a wave function, right? So psi n, ren always refers to a wave function. Let's say the ground state has one, and maybe by 46 you have the highest occupied state, right? Now, this is now, the two wave functions must be orthogonal to each other. We are thinking about really solutions of the, could be solutions of the Schrödinger equation, right? Real wave function. They must be orthogonal, so the scalar product must be identical to the Kronecker delta, right? And then this lambda are just the Lagrange parameters for the n squared constraints that I may have, or n times n plus 1/2. Yeah? Does that explain? Okay, so this is an index for the atomic positions. This you should consider as a vector, right? I'm dropping vector errors. This is actually today, I mean, normally it's just a constant. Today we use something that is G-dependent, right? Because we know the highest frequencies are introduced by the plane waves. It's the fastest oscillations, and therefore we have used an estimate of the Hamilton operator to make a good sort of preconditioning, right? Slow down the fast vibration, speed up the slow vibration. This is the DFT total energy, just the Kunsham energy. Okay, it's written again here. Here I have the occupations, kinetic energy. This is the Hartree term, this is exchange and correlation. And the total energy is again given by the individual wave functions, right? So the important bit here is that I only need to worry about the occupied states. States that will never be occupied, they don't play a role in my total energy function, so I never have to worry about them. That was one of the big advantages of the Carpinello method, because just imagine you have something like 10,000 degrees of freedom, you want to set up the Hamiltonian, 10,000 by 10,000. You need a pretty big computer to do that. In here, you just have to multiply the Hamiltonian on your wave functions, and that you can do very efficiently using Fourier transforms, right? So the kinetic energy is diagonal in G space, right? So what you do, a Fourier transform of psi into G space, you multiply it with G squared, you Fourier transform it back into R space if you wish, right? Same thing here. If you're, for example, in G space, you want to evaluate that, you calculate your density in G-space, then you do the Fourier, the interaction part in G-space, it's just 4 pi over G-squared. And then you Fourier transform the same thing back. And Fourier transform is an n log n operation, so it's just like a very simple operation, doesn't cost very much. And you never have to know your excited states. And that is very important, because you will even be able to store all of them. You can keep some of your excited states, but you just keep that part that you're physically interested in.
So FM is 1 or 0, or it's the Fermi function?
Depends. I mean, in the end, when it's converged, you want it to be the Fermi function, which is either 1 or 0. You can also introduce finite temperature.
Yeah.
Now, then, not with this function. You can add the entropy part of your total energy, which depends again on the occupations, and you have the moment function. That actually, the free energy of that, we actually minimize, and as a minimum, we obtain these occupations. So that's an extension of that. So this is sort of the simple-minded scheme. Now you add on. You make cell-shaped dynamics, you make this, there are all sorts of stuff. There's a whole slew of additional options.
Better statement on the first two equations about what you think. You want something which tends to call you back towards the ground state. So either you have something artificial, and that's the second equation, and that is something which is simply translating forces on fictitious classical variables, which will be pulled back towards. Or in the first case, you have two chances. Either you use imaginary time, and then you make Langevin, and that will work. That will call the wave function towards the ground state also, in a different way. But if you use the real dynamics and the wrong mass, that is not what nature does.
Yeah.
To make the average correct, you have to have a very small mass. That's what I was trying to say. Only if you have the real mass, then the dynamics will do the right thing, I think. Because then, really, ions would be followed by electrons, but if you put a larger mass, then it's not going to work.
I mean,
so that's what I meant by saying that you need the real mass for physics, not for mathematics.
Yeah. I mean, in both cases, you have to make sure that the Born-Oppenheimer principle holds. If it doesn't hold, you're doing something, right? And, okay. We know in nature, the Born-Oppenheimer approximation is a good thing to have. So if you break it, it's not good.
So temperature does not enter the equation.
Sorry?
Temperature, it does not enter the equation, any of
this equation. Not in this one. As I mentioned, if I want to introduce temperature, I mean, I can add temperatures in two ways. I can add temperature to the atoms and keep the electron So I have two temperatures. I have two systems, so each system has a temperature. The electrons and the wave functions, right? And the atoms. So if I want to control the temperature of the atoms, then I add a thermostat, which is an additional sort of, which adds a fluctuating friction to this bit, right? If I want to control the wave function temperature, then I have to introduce a moment function. So I have an additional term, which is a kinetic energy of this occupations. And secondly, you have a term that gives you the entropy minus Ts, right? That's just a moment function, which you have to add, and that gives you another dynamical equation now for the occupations, right?
And you don't do it.
I do it.
You do it?
Mm-hmm. I mean, if I want to. I mean, I can switch one on and the other off, I mean, depending on what I want to do. This thing is actually a very tricky thing, because it has, you can't just use F as the dynamical variable, because the frequency spectrum has, it's very broad, right? So can't integrate it. So here you have to be a little bit smart.
So you use the Hoover thermostat so as to make sure that the thing is fully time reversible. I mean, you actually check.
Yeah.
And you really check that if you time reverse, you go back to where you started.
No.
There are friction. I mean,
I know that I'm not coming back in practice, because the point is here in the constraints. If you write down the equations, you will see that to implement that absolutely exact, it kills you from the computational time.
Okay.
So we do a little approximation in here, which breaks your time inversion symmetry.
Okay.
Right? But that is more or less under control.
Okay.
More or less, I say. Right? Okay. But simply mathematically, you can write down that the rest, if you do this exact, you can mathematically simply show that you can invert the equations of motion.
Why do you want it to reversible?
Well, I mean,
again, doesn't need to be, but it's sort of nice if you want to obtain irreversibility to have really discretized reversible dynamics. So I was wondering if he did that. And I can see that discretizing that last term might cause some trouble. I mean, because I don't think anybody has thought too much about this lambda phi term.
But again, I think what he said about 2-3 phonon times, if you go back 2-3 phonon times, you'll approximately go back your way.
Right.
Probably it's not going to be exact.
I mean, what he's talking about, can you take a single time step and revert it? Do you come to the same point? Mathematically,
mm-hmm.
right? And mathematically, you can show it. And if you make, if you don't make that error, as we do in the real calculation, it comes back straight. Yes, reversibility. Actually, it's very important. We worry a lot about time reversal symmetry because that immediately tells you that your total energy is over long time scales converged. Otherwise, it's not. And if it's not, then, okay, you have big mess with your ensembles. Okay. So with that, I would like to summarize the carbon a little bit. Okay, so what have we gained? The big advantage is that we treat dynamics and optimization on an equal footing, right? We can both basically dynamically switch from one to the other, right? We can quench slowly, we can quench fast, we can do just dynamics, and it's just the same equation, you just change a parameter, which is very nice, right? You can obtain the ground state, again, by freezing. The big advantage is that we have a lot of feel and experience for classical systems. We can use all this knowledge, just import it from classical MD. And if you see all the fuzzy letters that came out from the first time of the Carpinello, they were all very exciting, but they were just a translation of techniques that have been used in classical dynamics since decades, just put in the new language. It's beautiful, right? Important is, you don't need self-consistency iterations during dynamics, and that makes the thing fast, right? Now, people will say, okay, if you do self-consistency iteration, you spend a little more time on each time step, but you make much longer time steps, right? This is sometimes true, sometimes not, right? For example, the time steps that we use for our dynamics is on the time scale that you have to use to integrate a proton. So if you just make classical MD on a with a system that contains a proton, you would use time steps that we use in our Carpinello simulation. So you can't gain anything. You can't make it smaller, can't make the time step larger, simply because the atomic motions are going that fast, right? So that's basically the big argument where the self-consistent iterations, they essentially lose out in that scheme. They have a certain advantage if you do metals, because in the metals, as I mentioned, this thing is not completely boiled out, right? So if you do self-consistent iteration, okay, you're staying on the Born-Oppenheimer surface, you have a jitter because you have to converge very, very well to really be on the Born-Oppenheimer surface, but you can at least do it and you can do it stably. If you do that with Carpinello, again, you have to understand the time scales, which is a lot more difficult. Once you have sorted it out, it's probably a lot more elegant. What do you need? This leads me to the PAW method. In order to do Carpinello, you need a well-defined total energy functional, right? It must be a unique functional of your wave function coefficients at atomic positions, and that, for example, excludes the use of methods like LMQ and LAPW, who just don't have wave functions that are uniquely defined by a set of variational parameters, right? These basis sets depend on the potential, and the potential is itself a derivative of the total energy. You can't use that. There are ways around it. If you think about it, there are ways around it, but they mess up to your time scales. So if you want to do it another way, again, you may run into different problems. So I don't want to talk about that. Important is, you have to, that's actually the point, you have to understand the time scales of your system. It's not just sufficient to know where your ground state is, you have to understand also the time scales. Otherwise, you're not...
Are you saying it's only a plane wave method which would work?
No.
No,
no, no, no, no, no. It has nothing to do. You can do with Gaussians. With Gaussians, you may have a certain problem with time scales, but let's leave that away. But with Gaussians, you can at least write on a total energy functional, right?
I mean,
any energy independent basis set will do it except for
energy and potential independent, yeah.
So, but let me make sure I'm getting this right. You're saying that the important point is to have a basis set which is independent
of the potential and the energy. Right.
But it confuses me. If you have an atom center basis, like the Gaussian, it depends on the potential via the position of the atom.
Exactly. No, it just depends on the atoms. The basis function is a Gaussian.
But what is the potential? The way that the electrons know where the atoms are is via the potential.
Yeah, but the electrons don't know. It's just a basis function. You just put the basis function here. You don't have to put an electron in there. Yeah.
The positions of the center of the Gaussians will depend
on atomic positions.
Yes.
On atomic positions.
Right.
But you don't have to solve an equation. I think that's the point, to find those Gaussians. See, in MTU, the atomic wave function depends on the potential because you have to solve for every potential.
Yeah.
A new wave.
You could do an LMTO calculation if you just say your potential inside the sphere is always frozen. You just freeze that. Then you can do this thing, no problem.
But has anybody done Gaussians? Kappa and Null with Gaussians?
There have been actually a calculation with Gaussians. Yeah, there are several ones. I mean, I think there's one in Canada by Salehub. There has been a very early one by Emily Carter at UCLA, who did actually, I think, TI calculations with Carpanello, something like that. So that really scared us a bit, but okay. She still does it, but on very small systems. But this was really scary at the time.
There are some people who claim that if you do self-consistent calculation like Gressa and you move atoms, it's actually much better than Carpanello. Can you comment on this?
He was saying before.
Yeah, I mean, they talked a little bit about that.
I talked about speed. Then there's a question of accuracy. Yeah, this is an argument that goes back and forth, right? You get a little bit into subtleties here, right? I mean, the point is, if you do a practical calculation, the question is, are you exactly on the Born-Oppenheimer surface or not, right? Okay, if you do the minimization scheme, it just means you have to be converged very well, right? It means, just let me finish, it means converge really well. In practice, you cannot afford that. So you always have a jitter and you have a drift in your total energy surface. Question is, how much of that drift is there? In our scheme, the Carpinello scheme has been bashed a long time because people didn't understand what actually is moving, right? They have looked, for example, at the instantaneous forces, and the forces were just 10-20% off, right? If you just take the atomic positions, you quench it down, you compare the forces with the forces you get into your dynamics, it's just 10 or 20% wrong. How can you do proper calculations? The point is, that's not the relevant force. You can very easily think, you should again think of a quasi-particle, right? So what you actually have is, you have the electron cloud tied to your atoms, right? They can oscillate. If you move around the corner, of course, the electron cloud will go a little bit outside from your atoms, right? And therefore you have a different force than if you would do it statically, right? It's just on the wrong point. If you correct for that factor, you get excellent forces, right? You can, even if you have errors of 30%, you can just attribute it to that single effect. It's a very simple problem. And that hasn't been understood for a long time, even by the Carpanello people. But we made comparisons and it just works beautifully. And of course, the other community doesn't know about that, right?
But
I think
maybe
it's simply
understood because on average it cancels out so that
that's
can
it.
You can have right trajectory
right.
Simply because of the oscillation because
here's the idea of the second order equation. The electron so oscillates around the nucleus, but over the long average they actually cancel
right.
out.
It's actually a free oscillation in the first case.
Without knowing you can be happy.
Yeah. But also there's a systematic thing. It's basically that when you move around the corner, the wave function and the atom separate a little bit. And that's a natural thing to happen. It's just that the atom should not be where you put your atomic position. It should be a little bit to the side of it, right? And that we can't calculate explicitly, right? But just comparing the instantaneous nucleus position is just not the right thing to compare with the real one, right? So even if you drive around the corner, you will see that effect. But you see that over long time scales, it doesn't affect your dynamics. And you can actually correct for it if you wish. Okay, let's go to the PAW method. Good. Let me just put it into its historical context. So if you think of the community of physicists, I'm not talking about what chemists do. I mean, chemists use mainly Gaussians or Slater orbitals, and it's a complete different world. In the physics world, I think history started around even just before the World War, basically with scattered waves and KKR, introduced, for example, by Slater. In this case, you have basically what you do is you think of atoms as point scatterers, calculate the scatter, the phase shift, and you essentially calculate how an electron bounces around in a solid between the atoms, right? You have to do that for each energy. You get sort of a determinantal equation. Basically, if the electron doesn't come out, you have a bound state, right? And you have to do that now for a lot of energies and find the zeros of a determinant, which is a difficult thing to do in a complex system. So that was what was done there. Because this is such a complex problem, it was used on model potentials, so-called Muffin-Tin potentials. That's where it comes from, because here you have basically you treat a point scatterer as a spherically symmetric scatterer, and in between you just want to describe it, for example, by plane waves or Bessel functions and so on, right? And if you do Bessel functions, you do KKR. If you do plane waves, you do the augmented plane wave method. Now, a little later, there were the empirical pseudopotentials where people said, okay, if you think about physics, we don't see very much of the core electrons, right? So why can't we get rid of them? If you put now an atom, if you just chop off the potential at some point, now we get rid of all the core states, we'll get rid also of the nodal structure of your wave functions, but we can still make the potential such that if you fit these parameters, it fits very well a band structure. Because we have the outer lobe of your atomic wave function that we describe about correct, and therefore we get the bonding properties right. So that was done for a while. We didn't know how to do that up in issue. One did it empirically by just fitting to band structures. Now in 1975, things changed dramatically. That's where Ole Andersen introduced the LMTO and the LAPW method. He essentially showed that you can map this problem onto a problem of energy-independent basis functions, right? Once you have that, you have opened the door for full potential calculations, right? So that's basically what keeps us busy up to now. A little later, there were the ab initio pseudopotentials. People learned how to do pseudopotentials, how to construct them, basically just knowing the solutions of a free atom. So you could now do basically material-specific calculations, also on systems where you didn't know the answer beforehand. Okay. Then this went on basically from 75 to 85, and then Carl Parnello came in with the ab initio molecular dynamics, which sort of gave us trouble in the all-electron world. And that's why I went into, tried to compare the two. Actually, just I made my PhD with Ole Andersen, and then I went to Yorktown and did pseudopotential calculation, and I had the same feeling that most of you have. I think most of you are all-electron people. I wanted to see real densities, right? And so I thought a little bit, what is actually pseudopotentials? And I came up with this scheme, right? And the big advantage here is that you have energy and potential independent basis functions. And that's what we need for the ab initio MD. So what do we have? Okay. PAW method is essentially a continuation, a natural continuation of both traditions. If you look into it, you will see that the differences between the two are not that big, right? And if you just do a natural development, if I just think how would LMTO or LAPW look in a couple of years, it would look like PAW, and the same thing here, right? So you can call it pseudopotential method or electron method or whatever, I mean, it's just the same thing. You can actually approximate, there's a well-defined approximation that gives you the ab initio pseudopotentials that we know from PAW. You can make a certain special case which is numerically rather cumbersome, and you get LMTO and LAPW, right? There's no difference. Okay, it's just a different way of viewing things. Okay, so it joins these two traditions and sort of hopefully takes the best of them. And it's built around the transformation theory, so it's a rather consistent theory, basically where you work in transformations between real wave functions and so-called auxiliary wave functions, or pseudo wave functions, as I often call them. The pseudo has nothing to do with the pseudo-potential approach, but Sergey will know, I mean, we call in LMTO the plane wave part pseudo wave function. I mean, that was basically where the name came from. Okay, if you do a transformation, you can also transform your operators, and then you can calculate your Oh, this is right. Okay, then you can calculate also expectation values with the pseudo operator, which is given in this way. So we put the tilde, everything when we want to call it auxiliary or pseudo, and we define new operators, and then you can work entirely on this numerically convenient wave function. The operator is given in this way. It's dependent on the atomic positions, but not on the wave function. We describe that in detail. So what do we gain? We can do ab initio molecular dynamics and with exactly the speed of pseudo-potential calculation, right? There's nothing that makes ab initio molecular dynamics more difficult than pseudo-potential calculation. We have, however, access to the full electron, all-electron waveforms, so we can calculate hyperfine parameters. Forces are very simple. That's important to do ab initio MD. There's basically no overhead. Hopefully, it's as fast as pseudo-potentials. In many cases, it's faster. And it seems to be, in many cases, accurate as accurate as LAPW. But of course, hopefully means the following. I think here, if you do a calculation of same accuracy, you're faster with PAW. Yeah? Okay. So that I can say pretty surely. Here, I'm still using the frozen core approximation, which gives me, in some cases, problems. For example, if I do certain hyperfine parameters for transition metals and so on, I believe that the frozen core is hurting me. If I do isomer shifts, this is certainly the case, and I'm now going to include soft core calculations because of that. For total energies, you don't see a difference. If LAPW is converged, it agrees with me. Yeah. Okay. I think if you do it just from the accuracy, it's in many, for example, for the hyperfine parameters, we did calculate, for electric field gradients, we did comparisons with experiment, and it was just, okay, the experimental error bar is rather large. But I agreed very nicely with Peter Blaha, and the experiments were all over the place. Which could also be a DFT problem, of course, but I would say that, it's not possible to say which one of the two methods is more accurate. I mean, it's just, if you do it right, you get the right answer. You can converge both to the Kuhn-Sharm limit.
If you do a total energy calculation for niobium, say, and you compare it with LAPW, do you get in the seventh digit the same number?
In the seventh digit? Depends on the unit.
Now,
as you know, if you take two LAPW programs, you don't get agreement in the seventh digit, right? No. I did LMTO calculation. I compared different LMTO calculations, which are really a lot more controlled than LAPW. And people have been completely surprised. The problem was I developed a tight binding LMTO code. I had to compare it with other codes, right? So I went to my supervisor and showing him the data, and he said, no, it's all wrong, look, this doesn't agree, right? So I went to another, to Ms. Christensen, compared with his, and agreed quite nicely with my results, right? So I think there's a scatter that you don't estimate, that you're not aware of. I think in electron, in one particle energies, you have easily a numerical error of a tenth of an electron volt, and you can't really get below that, just for numerical reasons, because you don't have a variational principle on that, right? In total energy, I think we can safely say that we can converge up to milli-Rydberg or milli-Hartree, right? Everything below that would be utterly expensive because, as you know, LAPW, there are few calculations that get LAPW converged to better than a milli-Hartree, right? Or milli-Rydberg per atom.
He was saying that his full potential optimized code was agreeing with LAPW. Within very high accuracy, very different methods, even different plane length programs don't agree that well.
Yeah. So, it depends on what the numbers are, right? If you tell me seven digits, no method will give you a number accurate to seven digits. I don't think we have one.
So, how many digits? Milli.
I think we can, we usually go to...
It can be seven digits, it depends how large is the system.
Right, that's true, yeah. No, I would say something like a millirittberg per atom or
a mark. Can you imagine total energy in niobium for your method compared to...
Yeah, I think that we would get. And would be heavy for me because putting very many K points in this is difficult. But doing a larger system, I mean, there I'm beating LAPW in speed. It doesn't matter. I mean, we can come to millirittberg accuracy. I think that's possible.
This one answer is interesting because you opened another question. Why is your K point problem so hard? And you said you have to put in many K points.
Well,
yeah, everybody has to put in many K points.
You need
no,
a lot
that's also in LAPW.
But the point is that LAPW is very good for small systems, right? So if you do a single atom, LAPW beats me like nothing, right? If you do five atoms, I beat LAPW like nothing, okay? In the speed, right? So doing a niobium one atom with many, many K points, that's expensive for me.
Yeah, but it cannot be more expensive than 10 times LAPW, and that's...
Yeah, I mean, it can. Yeah, so, if you want, I can give you niobium to millirittberg
so
accuracy.
This is now your statement. I have understood. Okay, and the K points, you want to use bigger unit cells for your.
No. I mean, I would do it. I mean, if you do niobium, you do it that way. The point is that, I mean, my problem is this is just how you code the thing. If I would be interested in metals, right? Then I would just write my code a little differently, and I would maybe not use Carpinello, but maybe diagonalization, and then I would get at least the speed of LAPW. I know the operation count is better than LAPW in any case. So that is no big deal.
So the problem is the molecular dynamics in the metal, rather than...
Yeah, and the way you do things, for example, I store, the thing is to make this thing fast, because you make Carpinello, you have very short time steps, so you don't want to save your data. So I'm keeping all my wave functions in central memory, right? So do 10,000 times one atom if you want to do K points, because I'm not using symmetry or anything, right? Because this thing is designed to move atoms. So any symmetry is immediately broken, right? So it's just, it doesn't have symmetry, right? So really that gives you a factor 48, right? Against LAPW. And that's why it's slower. So if it's not the question LAPW or PAW, it's a question how you implement the thing, right?
Oh, but there is a comparison. Comparison is very accurate.
Yeah. I mean,
there is a big comparison with LAPW because it's almost the same university.
Yeah. So no, also, I mean,
the two people sitting in the next door.
Actually, what we did.
Separate by law, but they make a comparison.
Yeah. And what we did actually is the first, when Karlheinz worked, I mean, I have a long-standing collaboration with Karlheinz Schwarz, right? Where the LAPW method has been developed, I mean, the Blaha type, right? So, the Vienna code, exactly. So, the first thing that the students in our collaboration did is do my PW compared with LAPW, and surprisingly, every time we got the same result, right? At some point, we stopped doing that, right? It has been done extensively, it has been done by the LAPW people. Right? Not by myself. I refuse to compare my method because I know I can squeeze out everything out of here, and I'm not sure I can squeeze everything out of every other method, so it would be biased. Right? But other people have done these comparisons. Every chemist, first thing they do, they compare with the methods they have, right?
But is it fair to say fast as good as potentially accurate as LAPW? That means the best you are living in the best of all worlds.
I would say for the things that I don't have certain options.
And could I modify that slightly? If I want, I can be as fast as total potential. If I want, I can be as accurate as LAPW. But then I may not be as fast as total potential.
That is possible. It's just, if I want, I can certainly beat it. I will show you, PAW is in principle the Kohn-Sham answer, right? There's no approximation in it.
It's okay to do a bit of advertising.
I'm not doing advertising.
It's advertising.
Right, okay.
It depends on which system. If you now are looking at system with moving atoms and maybe chemistry and so on, then that may be a fair statement because you're We're not saying it for any system, any time, but for those which are interested for moving atoms, it might be true, not just advertising it.
No, I would say, when I was a bit cautioning, then I said I don't have certain options, and I was referring to the soft core. Everything else I can do, everything that I can calculate, I can do as accurate as LAPW. I'm confident of that. Okay? Good. So, a little bit about the philosophy, because most of you come from a different world, and it takes a little rethinking to understand PAW easily, right? So the important is focus on total energy functions and not on potentials. Most electronic structure methods have been developed thinking about the potential and how to solve the Schrödinger equation, right? The emphasis is very different. What I'm going to do here is I will write down a total energy function, and I will not do anything else, because once I have this, knowing the ab initio molecular dynamics, forces and Hamiltonian are simply derivatives of the total energy function. And it's important, if you do Carpanello, that they are exact analytical derivatives of your total energy function. So the name of the game is to find a total energy functional from which you can form analytic derivatives, no numerical derivatives. Every numerical error will mess up your energy conservation. So that's absolutely forbidden. All approximations are therefore included in the total energy function, right? So I will get a total energy function, and you can see that that function agrees with the real functional, right? Once you have written this down, you're now in a new world, and you're doing everything exact in there, right? That is the same thing that I said before. Okay, what I want to do is also, I want to provide a well-defined language for quantum mechanical calculations, right? So I'm doing approximations, but I'm doing them absolutely consistent. So I tell you exactly, if you want to calculate a quantity, how should you do it, right? So that way you're safe to have everything consistent, and that's an old message of numerical calculations that helps you with error cancellations, right? Okay, this transformation theory is exactly the basics of this language, which allows me to go from numerically convenient to the physical wave functions. I use plane wave expansions, one-cent expansions. I'm not bound to do plane wave expansions. You can, for example, introduce some other envelope function, like in LMTO, whatever. In principle, there's nothing wrong with it. I just do it with plane waves. I make sure that in the plane wave expression, I only have smooth quantities. So I don't introduce any quantity that has a cusp or so on, and I just hope that this may be converged away. I only introduce smooth functions to plane wave expressions, right? So I know that I'm going to converge. And secondly, just to get speed, I have now one-center expansion, plane wave expansion, this one-center integrals. I have only one-center integrals and no multi-center integrals like in chemistry, because they are going to be expensive, right? Okay. So, now I talked a lot about transformation. What is this transformation? So, this is now textbook physics, but I just want to set your mind setting properly. So I start out with auxiliary wave function. You can think of that as the plane wave part in an LAPW calculation, or the envelope function in an LMTO calculation, or you can think of it as the wave function in the pseudo-potential calculations, right? That's all conceptually the same thing. Now I define myself a transformation operator T. Whatever that may be, I will define it in the future, but if I have such a transformation operator, this T gives me just the two wave function if I take the auxiliary wave function. It's just a transformation. Okay, now I express my total energy function. I take my real total energy function and just make this replacement. This gives me a total energy function that depends on my auxiliary wave functions, right? So what I want to find is the minimum of this total energy function, and it's absolutely irrelevant whether I minimize it with respect to psi or with psi tilde, because the minimum is always the same. Good. So I do this, and the equation, basically the gradient, the derivative of this equation, is nothing but the Schrödinger equation, right? Now, if you do this one, you just get h minus epsilon psi is equal to zero. That's a traditional Schrödinger equation. Now it's just different because I have to do the derivative with respect to psi tilde. So I get an equation like this, where the Hamilton operator has a transformation operator on the left and the right, And also, there's naturally something like an overlap operator, right? The overlap between two wavefunctions, no more psi psi, but it's the expectation value of this operator. And then I can calculate, once I have C tilde, I can calculate expectation values either by using this expression or by just transforming my operator into the world of auxiliary waves, right? And the art is now to find a transformation operator T such that the pseudo wave function that correspond to the physically relevant wave function, namely sort of the first few occupied states, is are numerically convenient, because only those I'm interested in, right? So that's what we are aiming for. Okay. So what is the PAW transformation operator? Let me just describe it, and if you want, I can go into the rationale why I came to this form and not to another form, right? So what I do is, the transformation is written in this way, the all-electron wave function. So remember again, the tilde up here refers to the pseudo wave function. It's a smooth quantity. This corresponds always, when there's no tilde, to the real quantity which has all the nodal structure in it, right? So what is it? It is given by the all-electron wave function. It's first given by the pseudo auxiliary wave function, the smooth object extending over all space. And then for every atom, I'm adding a little bit to it, right? So what is it in there? I have first here this index I, let me describe that. That index refers to an atomic orbital. I have a side index, I have a main angular momentum, a magnetic angular momentum, and an alpha index if I have more per angular, like a band index, right? You can think of it that way. Then I have here an all-electron partial wave. It's like phi and phi dot that you know. I just take a partial wave, I can take 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 per angular momentum, doesn't matter, right? Okay, so for each...
outward sphere or something?
Sorry?
Partial wave is just truncated somewhere else?
No, it goes out, but it's just not, it doesn't have to be normalized, right? You just, what you do is you take your atomic self-consistent atom, you juice an angular momentum and an energy, and you integrate outward. You take that thing. Right?
And that thing's diverging exponentially. Then.
Can be diverging, can be bound, whatever. The point is, it doesn't matter what's out there, right? You can also truncate it. You will see that that part will fall away anyway.
So okay. This is just a solution which is regular in the origin of some fixed atomic potential, or is there
right.
self-consistent spherical potential which you ultimately will have?
No, no, it's the atomic, I mean, it's a reference.
It's a basis.
It's a... This phi, I mean, once you, I mean, you're just constructing a fixed basis, yes. It's not depending on the self-consistent potential. It's really, before you do a PAW calculation, you do an isolated atom, make it self-consistent, right? And then you create this solution, and you keep them.
And that stays.
That stays. That's what you stick with, okay. Then for each of these wave functions, you're constructing for yourself a auxiliary partial wave, psi phi tilde, with the only constraint that it's supposed to be smooth when this is an interesting one, and so inside the sphere, and must be identical to the true one outside. And you see here why it doesn't matter what I do outside, because these things will cancel, right? And you define here some cutoff radius. You just, I mean, at some point, about at the covalent radius, the two should be identical. How you do that doesn't matter. It should be smooth. You don't want to introduce steps or kinks or something. You do it really fairly smoothly. Okay. Then these are these two objects. And you see I need the difference of the two. What is this based? This is the projector function. Don't mistake that with the projector operator. It's a piece of a projector operator, but it's I call it the projector function. It's just a state, right? And that is chosen such that when I write down this part, then it's identical to this part. So this contribution just cancels this contribution within one augmentation region, within one atom, right? So I'm left just with the remainder described by all electron wave functions, right? So this is this identity. The auxiliary wave function, the smooth object over all space within the atom, should be represented as a sum of auxiliary partial waves with some coefficients, and they are obtained with the help of projector function. And if you want to satisfy that, you can very easily show that you get that exactly when the projector functions are bi-orthogonal to the phis, right? It's important here to notice, many people make the mistakes. The phi tildes don't have to be orthogonal to each other. They can have an overlap. The p's don't have to be orthogonal to each other. It's just this bi-orthogonality condition that has to hold, right? That's important to notice. Okay. In principle, they should be complete. Okay, that's a question like convergence, like a plane wave convergence. You converge it, and when you are stable, then you stop. It converges actually rather rapidly.
Oh. I mean, the question that people ask is: now we are left with the phi inside this zone, and a combination of those. Who tells you that this combination will converge to describe the electron inside this region of space? You have to basically to increase the angular momentum or whatever, the I to infinity to convert.
How
do you truncate?
How do I truncate? I do it in practice like that, that I simply take a few, and then I just do a calculation with one, then I do a calculation with two, with three, with four, and I see after two, nothing is happening. You can actually make expansions. No, you can make one thing that's important. You can make
energy convergence to say micro electron.
Yeah.
So to compare with the LFPW calculations, one has to increase the basis set inside this small zone until the total energy is basically converged and say micro electron.
Look, I mean, I don't want to talk about microelectron volt, but I mean, it's like in LAPW, you have to converge the angular momentum. And the point is, the fun thing is that LAPW does not converge to the correct result, because all your partial waves are constructed from a spherical potential, and that information is left over. Right?
I think the reason why you need a few depends that you choose the radius reasonably small, which you usually don't do with LAPW.
Yeah.
You are sort of doing like pseudo potential.
No, it's basically that I take the difference between the two. This expansion, if you just take these coefficients, multiply it with that, is converging terribly, absolutely awful. This expansion is converging terribly. The difference between the two you can easily see. If you go to high energy, you have free electrons, whatever you do. The potential doesn't matter. So these two become almost identical at higher energies, and that's why this thing is converging, because you're always going to the difference. That's the point.
When you talk about Rossi-Korff approximation, fix the phi
eyes. Oh, the phi eyes anyway are frees. But I freeze. This is done only for the valence wave functions. The core wave functions are kept fixed. Take it from the atom, and I just keep the core density frozen. I just shift it around with the atom. That's what it's done right now. Good. So I show that with a few pictures. That's the best. So this is an example of a wave function. This is a bound state, the P sigma state of chlorine molecule. It's not even the highest occupied state. Doesn't matter, right? Just has a nice bond charge. So you see that the true density here has the spikes, right? And that makes it basically impossible to expand it by plane waves, right? So what we're doing here, we're now looking down here at the decomposition along a cut through the two atoms, right? So that's what you're seeing here. And I've here written the expansion again. Now I've used this notation that the expansion in the true partial waves is written by psi 1, 1 for one center. Right? It's not a power. This thing with the coefficients is called psi tilde 1, right? And the idea, the way to read this equation is that within the sphere, this and this is identical, so you're left with this one, with the true wave function. If you go outside your sphere, then these two are pairwise identical, so you're left with the pseudo wave function. If you go outside the augmentation region, everything is plane waves. If you're inside, everything essentially is partial waves, right? Good. Now, what are these bits?
That's a wave function, not a density.
This is a wave function, yeah. Did I say density? Okay. It works the same way for the density. Mm-hmm. Good. So what we see here is now the cut. You see here the two wave function with all the spikes. It's just, it's actually the sign is right, yeah? So this is a true wave function. And this is a pseudo wave function. right? So inside the atoms, it doesn't have this oscillation, it's just a smooth continuation. And that blue thing is this spot, the black thing is this object, right? Now, what I'm missing, if I would just stick to the blue part, that's what you do in the pseudo-potential calculation, right? Then you left out this bit, right? You want to get this back. So what do? You want to get it back, you go, for example, here. Now, you know, in this region, plane waves is an awful thing to use. But you know that atomic orbitals is a beautiful thing to use in that region because the potential is steep, so you have a stiff differential equation. You get away with a very small basis set. That's why phi and phi dot is gorgeous, right? Any other basis set would be terrible. So we take atomic numerical solutions of the atom and just superpose them and build here now the all-electron wave function shown here, that's a red bit, and we make another expansion now in this pseudo-partial ways, that's a green part. And you see per construction they are identical as you go away from the atoms. Take the difference between the two, put it back here, right? So what?
The red thing is the all-electron atomic wave function.
The red thing is the one-center expansion into one-center orbital of the all-electron, right? And the green one is the same thing, but for the pseudo wave function, for the auxiliary wave function, right? So you may ask, how good is that, right? So you take, for example, let's take the all-electron wave function and its part. This is a comparison of the all-electron wave function and its partial wave expansion. So you see, it's extremely accurate near the nucleus, and gets a little worse as you go away because we have not introduced the right number of angular momenta. But it doesn't matter in this region because the two are anyway equivalent, right? So the arrow cancels. And that's just the principle of additive augmentation that is also used, for example, for angular momentum in LMTO. That way I say the PAW method is actually closer to LMTO than LAPW because it drives this principle a step further. Good. And this is now the difference between the pseudo wave function, the auxiliary wave function described by plane waves, and its one-center expansion expanded in partial waves. So you see here the difference, right? So this is the full one, the blue one, and the green one is the corresponding one-center expansion. Yeah? Good. So this is for a real system. These are not hand-drawn figures. This is just taking out of a real calculation. Yeah? Okay. Any questions to that? Now, projector functions, how do they look? That's what they are. So actually for this calculation, I think we went to D, or I'm not sure, I asked Clemens just to plot everything into D. So you see, this is about the covalent radius, right? So this is centered on an atom. It's rather smooth, and it's strictly localized within an augmentation region, a Muffentin radius, for example. You have one, you can put a second one. The first one is usually nodeless, the second one usually has a node. You do this. You can also add a third one that would have three nodes usually, and so on. You can also put projector functions for P. You see it has the P character. So when you make the scalar product of this function with your wave function, you pick out the P character, right? Same thing for this one. You pick out two different P characters, right? That allows you, for example, to differentiate between phi and phi dot. Or you can pick out D, or you can go higher, whatever, right?
So the 1S and the 2S are not.
No.
What is the freedom? Is it the kick?
You also have the partial waves. This one must, the scalar product of this with the first partial wave must be 1, and the scalar product of this with any other partial wave must be 0. Right? So if you make the scalar product with the wave function, you just pick out the character of the first partial wave. Same thing with this one, it picks out just the character of the second partial wave, whatever that may be, right? And important is that the scalar product, forming the scalar product with your wave function, just picks out the character of the wave function, the local character of your auxiliary wave function. And that gives you then the coefficients in your expansion.
So you just choose those p's to be defined only within the sphere, do you?
Yeah.
If you have a complete set of partial waves, there's a unique bi-orthogonal set in principle, which is just obtained by multiplying the partial waves by the inverse of the overlap matrix, and they would therefore be extended, yeah?
It's not unique. it's not unique. You can do it in, I mean, of course, if it's complete, then everything is unique in a way, because you can make transformations. There is a unique way. You start out with certain, with sort of, say, a basis set for partial waves. You start out with 5 partial waves. You start out with 5 projector functions. And then you have to biorationalize them, which you do with a Gram-Schmidt kind of procedure. And that way you make sure that if you add one, it's just a small correction to what you already have, right? And yeah, that's basically what is done. And the basis set you choose, that it's localized, right? Of course, complete means always complete within some augmentation region. Does not mean complete in all space, right? And the piece don't have to complete, be complete anyway. It's just, but then, okay, it's just the phis and the phi tildes that have to be complete, yeah?
So you have tremendous flexibility in the
field,
isn't it?
Right. Oh, yeah. Actually, this flexibility boils down because there are certain conditions that you can exploit to make it in a smart way. And then you will see there's hardly any flexibility left, right? So once you define your partial waves, your electron partial waves, you have different schemes to derive pseudo-partial waves, but then you're essentially done, right?
But the P's amount more or less to the choice of the cutoff function in Hamming-Schmidt-Chantal potentials or something close to that, right?
It comes to that, but it comes from the fact that you use, the way I produce my partial waves is actually analogous to your procedure, right? So the pseudo-partial wave is constructed that way, right? And this construction boils over, then automatically you get something like that in the product.
So to follow up on Matthew's question, I mean, you define so far the phi sub I, which are the wave functions of the atom, then the phi sub I twiddle, which are the pseudo wave functions. Now we have to define the P's. And the equations that you gave us is not enough to determine them. So you have to add another set of conditions to produce a unique, well-defined definition of these PI twiddles.
No? Right, right.
I mean, it seems to me I've produced a really stupid set of P's that satisfy that just those orthogonality equations. And then I will presumably get really stupid answers. That's what worries me.
Yeah, it will take you a long time until you converge. But it will always work. Let's say if it's convergent. Sorry?
You haven't got a convergence criterion on the P.
Well, he has to provide a definition. To define a method, he has to make the definition unique. Yeah. Right?
There is, yeah, right. I mean, this is, right, exactly. So in practice, I have another requirement, namely to reproduce the atom exactly. And that gives me a unique description for the piece once I've defined my phi tildes. Okay? Maybe we can leave that for the afternoon, yeah?
Okay.
If there's another discussion.
So let me make sure I understand. For a given set of phi tildes, there is no unique set of phi tildes, of course. They are not uniquely defined for phi tildes, right?
Let's see. As far as I said it here, no. In practice, yes.
Okay.
There's a recipe.
Yes. I mean, the equation phi tilde p tilde equals delta ij is not enough.
Right.
No,
the uniquely.
That's another
then
there
condition. Is some
right.
Experience or some
ambiguity. No. It's very simple. I mean, it's
we'll
one.
Okay.
Yeah.
I will tell you exactly what it is. And you will see there's no ambiguity in that. Okay. So if you're happy with that, I leave the rationale for the afternoon because I'm already running out of time. I want just to show you how things tie together. So this is my wave function. So I've defined the transformation, and I've therefore defined my basis set in a way, right? Now I have to calculate physically relevant quantities. I have to be able to calculate expectation values, right? So how do I do this? There's this formula, right? If you take the transformation, you will see that you get 9 terms, right? 3 of these terms are written here. This one is actually not in the transformation operator, that's a core state. And the other 6 or so, they converge away. They just vanish when your partial wave convergence is correct, and I'm not including them in the practical calculation. So POW gives you a unique recipe how to calculate this. Calculate the expectation value with the pseudo wave functions. Then you take the one-cent expansions. You see there are certain coefficients. Here you have the scalar products of projector functions and pseudo wave functions. They are just condensed into a matrix, and then I have the expectation values between my partial waves, and then I have to subtract the expectation values between the pseudo partial waves. So I have to calculate these 3 objects and just put it together, and I'm done. There
is an intuition why the cross terms are zero, phi I A, phi I Twiddle.
Yeah, there's some intuition, and I think we would leave that also for the afternoon.
Okay.
Because it's
okay.
I have it here if you want,
oh,
but
no,
it's a longer thing. Yeah. Okay, good. Important here, that's actually something I wrote it in my initial paper in the text, but not in the formula, and that, for example, got Gyorgyassy confused, and that's why he thought he had to do better. This is always included. There's always the contribution of the core states, otherwise you have just the expectation values of the valence states, right? Good. The one center matrix is this thing, so you calculate once the scalar products of your wave function with the projector functions, you keep them, and then you condense this matrix, and you do this. And you see this one is now just single-site atomic integrals, right? So no multi-center terms. If this operator is sufficiently local, which all the operators that we need so far are, right? Good. So then the operator, the pseudo-operator, can write this also as the expectation value of a so-called auxiliary operator, pseudo-operator on my auxiliary wave functions that has simply this form, right? This is what the pseudo-potential people call a separable potential. It has exactly that form. And if you do the thing for the Hamiltonian, you will get here a pseudo-potential in its non-local form. That's a relation to the pseudo-potential approach, right? That is also a nice way. For example, if you do a pseudo-potential, so there are two ways of doing POW. I do it self-consistent and consistent. So there are also people who say, I have this nice pseudo-potential code and doing the POW is too hard for me. So let's take my pseudo-wave function and use these operators with it, right? And then calculate quantities. And that's, for example, what Francesco Mauri does when he calculates chemical shifts, right? And that's basically also the way that we did. Actually, I started this myself together with Chris. Chris was asking me how to calculate hyperfine parameters with a pseudo-potential code. And that was before I had written up the code, so I told him, okay, there's a quick recipe, just apply this and you get the right results, and that works beautifully. That's what all the pseudo-potential people do when they calculate hyperfine parameters.
What do you say that you have only one center integral, you have I and J different in your...
On the same site, on the same site.
I and J have the same big R, right?
Right,
they
yes.
only differ by L, M,
right.
Alpha,
sites. Exactly, yes.
Two different sites, there's no difference.
And this, you see it immediately because these matrix elements are pairwise identical if you go from one site to the other, right? So I didn't separate it. It's really a sum over different sites and then a sum over the ij's on this side.
Right. So on that equation on the bottom, should you also have a core term?
Not in the operator. The operator, yes, the core is just, I mean, here it's really, yeah, right. The core term is just the true A applied to the core wave function. You can write it in a similar way, but I haven't. You can actually say, okay, the only thing that you can't do is these coefficients, but you can write it in a similar fashion. Also for the core states, there's no difference. Good. So the quantity that we need in density function theory is the electron density, which is shown here. So you see exactly what I've shown you before. You have an operator. The operator is just the expectation value of the two R bars and kets. And you get, again, a decomposition of a pseudo part, a one center part, and a pseudo one center part, right? And this is, again, a thing that is local within each sphere. And basically, okay, here it's actually written in detail. So here, the pseudo part is given by squaring this auxiliary wave function and multiplying with the occupations. Plus a pseudo core, and that is important. That is what Gyorgyassy, for example, in this paper overlooked, that I have this included automatically. So he left it out, and then he saw he runs into problems because of nonlinear core correction and so on, and he had to go through several steps to get this back in, which is, to my opinion, a little awkward. If you add it right here, you never have to worry about that in the first place. Then you have here the one center part, so this you can again write as a sum over R plus these things. So you have the partial waves and this one center density matrix plus the true core, and if you wish, also the nuclear charge, if you want. And then you have to subtract this part, which is just the one center expansion of the quantity up here, right? And here you subtract out this pseudo core again, right? So this way you shift the pseudo core into the plane wave part, without making an error. You subtract it out again. Okay.
Question. If you wanted to calculate non-log quantities, like for example the one-body density matrix, say solid, would this be problematic?
It would be more difficult. The equations as I've written them down here would not work if you have a real non-local operator. But you could fix it up. Because you know what...
It's difficult to tell the method from the insulator by looking at the non-local insulator. For example, I mean, if you write n of r and r prime as a function of the center of mass and relative coordinate, then can distinguish a metal from an insulator by decay with respect
to
the relative form. Would you be able to see that?
I mean, you would certainly see it, right? I mean, that's not the question. You have to write down the expectation value, and I think it won't even be difficult to do that. But I would have to sit down. I mean, if you give me to this afternoon, you write down for me the operator that you want to see, I probably can give you an expression. But let's say we have kind of non-local terms, not in the expectation values, but when we calculate electrostatic interactions, we use similar tricks in the total energy, and there we actually have non-local terms. Now, it has been so far always possible to find a decomposition such that the non-local parts are all condensed in here, and here you only have local quantities. It just works out, right? I mean, give me an example, I show you that it works, right? Okay.
Yeah, sure.
It is obvious?
It's not so
obvious. Oh, okay. Yeah.
Okay, we'll do that.
I mean, this is experience. You might come up with an operator that I cannot numerically write down in a nice fashion. It's possible.
But in any case, it's an exact formalism, so the worst that can happen is that you will have to compute it.
All the known terms, yeah, right.
Which is not the end of the world.
Right. Okay. Once we have the density and we have the wave function, we put everything together in a total energy function, and surprise, surprise, also that decomposes into three bits, where one is calculated entirely in a plane wave expansion, so just plane waves and smooth integrands, and this part is a sum over one-cent expansions for each atom in terms of all electron wave functions that's treated in on radial grids multiplied with spherical harmonics, and this is the same thing just for the pseudo, using the pseudo density and the pseudo partial waves. What are the different parts? So if you're getting tired, just tell me. I give you the flavor of it, right? So this is the kinetic energy of the pseudo wave functions. Then I have to subtract out the one center part within the sphere, and I have to add in the true one, right? Which is this one. Okay. Now electrostatics. That's actually the interesting bit. So what we have here, let's start here. This is the true one, right? So add the density and the core is already in there, and at the nuclear charge, I calculate that integral. Now, when I do this, then I will see that the charge here, and if I add these two charges, they don't cancel out. There's a monopole and multipoles on this side, right? Because the number of electrons in this integral is not the same as this. So therefore, I introduce here something that I call a compensation charge density, which is simply a superposition of Gaussians that are localized, built in such a way that the one center densities don't interact with each other on different sides. So if I take the true density and the pseudo density, perform the difference on one side, it must not have any multiple moments. And I add Gaussians until that is the case. Exactly. Now, when that goes back to Weyrich, yeah. Okay, good. Weyrich actually started with something like that. Not Weyrich.
I know it from Hammond.
I knew it from Hammond too. But
okay, that's possible.
I don't know what's bringing
it. It goes back into the darkness of history. That is true. Okay, but this is one way how you deal with non-local parts, right? Okay, then I don't have to introduce the rest. I mean, simply here is a potential which is useful, not necessary. So you add and subtract expressions to make convergent properties nicer. So that's one trick that's used here. And I think that's all clear, right? So once I have this total energy, it's a unique function of my pseudo wave function in my atomic positions, and then I can calculate everything that's left, namely forces and the Hamiltonian. Everything follows from this. And I'm not doing any more approximations, so that's why I'm not talking about it anymore. This is just cumbersome, the page-long equations to work it out, but it's just machinery. Good. So you want to know what are the approximations. They are pretty well defined. Okay, I have the frozen core approximation. I'm just trying to get rid of that, which will take me a little longer. You have to truncate your plane wave expansion because your computer is finite, but that you can control nicely by just playing with the plane wave cutoff. So you have a single parameter that you screw, and when nothing is changing, you're done. Secondly, this you also do in the pseudo-potential codes or in LAPW. There's something else, namely you have to truncate your partial wave expansions, and that tells your augmentation. Now the method is not variational with respect to this parameter. That's something many people stumble upon. It's just not variational. But it converges, and when it's converged, you have the right result. This series converges extremely fast. And we know that from LMTO, there you work essentially with two well-chosen partial waves. Here you get actually away with less than two. You can often work with one quite well. That's what most pseudo-potential calculations actually do. And that is simply because you exploit this additive augmentation. You make your series expansion much faster convergent. The plane wave convergence, I typically use something like 30 Rydberg, and that works for almost everything. If you have something like copper or oxygen, you're beyond the Miller-Hartree boundary, right? You go a little higher. But since these are the only atoms and the chemistry is rather well understood, I sacrifice a little accuracy here. Everything else I can describe here. If you do silicon, you can probably get away with something like 10 Rydberg, like pseudopotentials. If the convergence here is poor, I can use a construction such, simply borrow construction from the pseudo-potential world to get exactly the plane wave convergence of any ultrasoft or non-conserving pseudo-potential, right? So if I want, I can beat every pseudo-potential, at least come equal to every pseudo-potential code. Partial wave expansion, typically one or two. If I do electric field gradients, I put a third one, or if I want to really make sure. I have now done basis sets where in the program you have a screw and you do 1, 2, 3, 4 for S, 1, 2, 3, 4 for P, and you know exactly where your convergence is, what you need. Okay. By including the full density and the full wave function, you got rid of all the transferability problems in the pseudo-potential approach, and that has been, Georg showed that very nicely, and also Emily Carter at UCLA. Most pseudo-potentials, almost without exclusion, fail for high-spin transition metal atoms, right? PW, that's beautiful. Compares
well. One question people may ask, when you put 1, 2, 3 partial waves, you calculate them at different energies, and that will ask the question whether energy matters, where you choose that energy. Absolutely, because, you basically... You change the energy and you calculate the partial wave and you calculate it and you do the calculation. Now, if you move a little bit, that partial wave, say by 0.2 Rydberg or something, what will happen?
Nothing much.
What's the error?
You can estimate the error very easily by including the next function, because that is like introducing phi double dot, right? Or phi triple dot if you take the fourth, right?
No,
tells you the energy derivative. Yeah.
No, because that's calculated one single energy. And then you take the derivatives. This is, you choose, say, a binding energy plus another energy, which is higher.
Yeah. So if you want to work with a single one, that depends on your system, right? So some systems you can describe with a single partial wave, if you chose the partial wave right. Some don't, right? And some depend more on it and some less. So there's no answer. You have to converge to get the right result. Before that, it's ill-determined. It's very system dependent. There's no general rule to use.
You have to orthogonalize those various phis?
To what?
To each other.
No. You can put an energy grid which is really very, very dense.
But then they're not going to be orthogonal to each other.
They don't have to.
Okay.
with the integrative forces,
yeah,
people use Helmut Feynman.
Mm-hmm.
Now, for the LFPW, that was for a long time a problem because you had to be numerically highly accurate to get that.
Mm-hmm.
That's no problem in your.
No, because I don't use the Hermann-Feynman theory. The problem is all four theorems are exact, give the same result if you're converged. LMQ and LPW, because they use a spherical core, the forces often point in the wrong direction if you don't calculate the forces correctly. You have to do... The thing is, here's one description. There's no choice whatsoever. Take your total energy functional. You have some atomic positions in there. You derive that for fixed wave functions. That's the force you're going to take. Because otherwise you're double counting forces for the electrons and the atoms. Because the electrons have an independent dynamics, right? So that's just one choice. All the question about force theorems you can just discard. It's irrelevant here. It's the wrong thing to do. Force theorems are useful if you have an unconverged basis set or an unconverged calculation, how to still get good forces, forces that are similar to the converged results. And the Hermann-Feynman theorem, if you take it strictly, like the force on the nucleus, in most all electron calculation points in the wrong direction. You can actually calculate at what atomic number the force changes sign. It's a funny thing.
That's why you didn't want the force. I mean, the reason is that you had a limited basis set, and you wanted to have a force and a total energy which agree reasonably, even if you are not converged to those seventh digit. And that's why you use the force theorem, and you like some fixed basis set. And now, in your case, you have to do something else because you have part of the basis set which is moving with the atoms. So
right.
There is no way to use Hermann-Feynman. You have to be very accurate. The only way to calculate will be very accurate. You cannot have approximate forces or approximate energy.
No, it has nothing to do with approximation. Even if I do a very poor calculation, I cannot use a force theorem. You cannot do Carpanello with the force theorem. It just does not work.
No, you have
conceptually the wrong thing.
Because
yeah.
You are not taking advantage of this,
right,
which is fit for that kind of theorem.
So what you do with the force, you do only corrections with the force.
I mean, they're implicitly included. You see, my basis set is depending on the atomic position, so my total energy function depends on the atomic position.
Well, you need an analytical force.
Sorry?
You need an analytical force.
Sure.
So
I make an analytical...
You need pilot plus Pooley correction.
Yeah?
Yeah.
I mean, you just don't worry.
The dependence of the basis.
It comes automatically, right? You just don't worry about it.
Peter. Also, but even independent of basis set issues, the force is only isn't variational, like the energy is.
Yes.
So my question is, since you're a little bit off the Born-Oppenheimer surface, this is going to affect your forces worse than it affects your energy. Does that cause drifts? It's not a basis set question. It's just a question of deviation from self-consistent.
Yeah, but look, the way is we don't separate atoms and electrons. This is just a dynamical system, so you find the minimum, right?
But the point is that your force isn't quite, it's decoupled. It's it's accurate to a lower order than your energy is.
Right.
So does that mean, does that affect the dynamics? That's my question.
Look, this is only true when you're at the ground state. If you're not at the ground state, your total energy is not variational with respect to the atomic positions anyway, because otherwise you wouldn't have a force, right? So actually the force on the force on the electrons, of course that is also not in the ground state, so it also has a force, right? So the two are of the same order. The thing that you have to worry here is just consistency, right?
That's what I'm asking.
And if you, this is just how you do classical MD. You write down the total energy function, you calculate derivatives, and that's it. See, that's why we started from the fictitious Lagrangian, in order to get all the equations of motion absolutely consistent with each other, right? So we don't start writing down equations of motion and just fiddle around with them. We write down a Lagrangian, and then we write down the equations of motion following from them, right? And we do it absolutely exactly. So what I can do is I can take in my code one wave function component, change it a little bit, form the numerical derivative, and this will be identical to the instantaneous term that I get for h times psi, right? So I can take every single variable, variational parameter in my scheme and make the not analytic derivative, discrete derivative, and it will give me the right result, right? So
I'm still a little funny about the wave functions. They're not eigenstates of anything, right?
No.
These functions. They're just plane waves that are augmented or something. Is that what they are?
Yeah.
So they have some these occupation f's.
Yeah.
I mean, how do you pick them since they're organized by energy?
The thing is, the thing will organize themselves. You give it a few times. Since it minimizes the energy, these states will condense in the Hilbert space of your occupied states, because if you have a state that you treat as occupied, which is not one of your occupied states, then you have a higher energy because you excited an electron, right?
To the question of Mark, can I just say that I apply the transformation T, H, T dagger, now I have a pseudo Hamiltonian, and then I treat it like an ordinary Hamiltonian.
Yeah.
So I have occupations and everything is well defined, no?
You can also do that, yes. You can do, you can also do conventional calculations with PAW. PAW is just an electronic structure method like any other also, right? It's not depending on ab initio.
Pseudo wave functions are eigenstates of the pseudo Hamiltonian, just like waves. So you can use the usual machinery.
Yeah.
That's a nice thing about the transformation theory. It makes everything well defined.
The answer to Vernon's question is you don't use Hermann Feynman because you use simply the derivative of the total energy. This is the answer. So you will have a piece which looks like Hermann Feynman plus another piece where you have the derivative of the functions with respect to positions.
Right, and of a term that you can identify with Pauli corrections.
Or he could use Hermann Feynman on the pseudo Hamiltonian, why not?
No.
That should contain everything.
No, because part of his y function is moving. So
that would be contained.
Yeah, that would be contained in the super
yeah.
T.
So one can also do that.
Yeah, but I think the way it looks inside, it's a little bit scary.
I think we're talking now about Hermann Feynman. I mean, you're talking exactly about Hermann Feynman, what it is. It's variational principle, right? And the thing is, it's just not a useful concept here. You can use it, but it's just not giving you anything. And what you just said, use Hermann Feynman on the pseudo-potential, means including Pauli forces.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. Yes.
So that's what chemists would say, that you are including Pauli forces.
Yes.
Right? Correct. So we can translate it all in these terms of Pauli forces.
Okay.
Okay, so maybe since we're talking about DMFT, I just want to show you how you can use this thing to do LDA plus U, for example, and DMFT is no different, right? So what we do is we want to have our wave function represented in two tight binding orbitals. So we pick tight binding orbitals and they are defined HiIs. What I've done here in addition is I've put here a twiddle on top. So I use my transformation to make a auxiliary tight binding orbital, which just is fairly smooth, just for the sake of the argument. Now, what I want to have is actually, I want to have this wave function represented in this orbital. So I have to, again, to do a transformation. So what do I do? The best thing that I can do is make a least square fit, right? So I write down a functional, which is the difference, you enter the difference between the pseudo wave function and this superposition of tight bindings. Then you put some weighting factor, which for convenience express here by terms of projector functions. And then you again have the difference on the other side. Why did I choose that? These projector functions are designed to give you the local character of a wave function inside an atom. That's exactly what you're looking for. So these are actually ideal, and you have already calculated them. So you don't have additional effort. And then there's no U. I'm not even talking about U. Here. I'm just telling you how you can represent this in orbitals. If in an orbital language, it's very easy to write down U, right? You write down the occupation of these orbitals by squaring the CIs, you have the number of electrons in these orbitals, and then you multiply it with U and you have a total energy. Yeah. So that's a true
part. What's the physical meaning of the functional F that you're writing here?
This is simply the mean square deviation between this and that, weighted with something in between.
I think he's just fitting his side to a linear combination of atoms and functions. Right. That's what he's doing.
Okay.
That's all.
This is almost dull, right? Okay, so I form the derivative with respect to the C's and the CJ's, and I get an expression where psi tilde, by reinserting the result in here, psi tilde is given as a sum of this pseudo local orbitals, and then you have to invert the matrix and you have to do things, and in the end you have to form a scalar product between your projector function and the pseudo wave function, which I've calculated anyway, so now nothing else. And you can write this basically in a way very similar to the old projectors. Actually, there should be here a sum, so you can define projector functions for this tight binding orbitals, right? If you want to have the full density, then you do the same thing. You just replace here the tilde, so to take the real orbital, and you get here the real wave function, right? So you get this identity. And the piece, the projector function on the tight binding orbitals, you can write a superposition of this projector function I use in the PAW, and then the coefficients here, they are given by this matrix, which you do once and for all in the beginning of your calculation. Once you have that, you have a function that depends on the wave function given in this local orbital, so usually you just need those. And you do your thing, calculate your total energy and add it to the rest. And then you form your derivatives like everything else, and you get your forces and Hamiltonian and so on, right? You don't have to worry about it. So this is basically how you do LDA plus U. And you can make choices. And for example, you can do this omega C, just coefficients, which bias the fit. Usually you would take them just diagonal on each side and so on, right? So this is very simple. Questions to that?
That's similar to what Ole does, which is when he falls back to
states in Fermi energy? I don't think so. Because I'm not changing the orbital. You give me something. This may be stupid or good, right? I'm just expanding the wave function into this wave function. For Ole, it's really, he has basis function. He wants to reduce the size of his Hilbert space into the relevant portion. And that's the downfolding. So it takes everything that he needs from this upper part of the Hamiltonian. He knows something about the potential. So he puts everything back to get a very small and very optimum basis set. I'm not doing that, right? So this thing, you give me. It can be a tight binding LMTO. It can be anything else. It can be a Gaussian. I don't care.
You also provide the opening matrix movements?
No. The hoppings, they're already with the two wave functions, so I would go outside. I mean, if you then, I don't want to, see, I mean, I could probably condense my Hamiltonian to such a subspace, but I don't want to do that because then you introduce errors, then why not starting from LMTO in the first place? What we want to get, we want to have the hopping from this side into the environment and back described with the full basis set. We don't want to make an approximation here. So the hopping is really the hopping from your local orbital into augmented plane waves. Right?
You know, I'm still trying to understand what is the definition of your Q?
The Q?
The capital Q. At the very bottom of the page.
That is simply defined. This thing, I want to...
At the bottom.
Down.
Oh, this?
Yes.
This would be... Let's say if it were LDA plus U, I would probably write
Is it an operator? It has to be an operator, right?
Yeah. So first I have to get NI that is defined by right, so that's the number and the sum over all states. This is the occupation of the tight binding orbital here I, right, of this orbital, right? So the total energy, which is my delta E, is the Q, which is written as sum over I J U I J N I N J. And I'm not worrying here about spin indices, right? They are easy to include, okay. Right? And you insert for each and I this thing.
Okay.
And then you, of course, double counting and so on. Okay. But the principle is clear, yeah?
Okay. So the philosophy is first you take the pseudo wave function, and from the pseudo wave function you extract the orbital character.
Right.
Then you go back to the real wave function, and then from the real wave function you extract those NIs. and then you have a
real beam. I mean, this is one step, right?
It's sort of a little bit.
So the only.
About, but
sorry? No, no, it's one step. You don't go back and forth, right? I mean,
no,
first,
I understand.
You have to define, you have orbitals, so you have to define a projector.
Right.
That's the first thing. Then you have to project. So you build the scalar product with the wave function.
Yeah. I mean, philosophically, one would worry that you didn't keep that the pseudo wave function doesn't have very well the orbital character, but
probably if it has, then
take more projectors and you know. You just have to convert it.
All right.
Yeah? Okay. So, I have to advertise a little bit, but I do this quickly. So PAW is not only in my code, but there are a number of other people, like also the VAS code, Maury has done something, the people in Cornell working on it, there's one in San Diego and so on. These ones are the first after me, they're in Wake Forest in North Carolina, who did actually without ab initio MD, so they do standard. Actually, I think my code is the only one that really used the fictitious Lagrangian. All the other ones are standard implementations of PAW. What can you do? This thing has grown. It has something like probably 130,000 lines by now. You can do ab initio MD, you get the full wave functions, you can do electric field gradients. I have to put here a certain question mark. I found that for transition metals, this doesn't come right. So probably I need the soft core before I can really claim this. I have a number of functionals, gradient corrected, not gradient corrected. I can do spin unrestricted, spin restricted, or I'm talking chemist. Spin polarized, spin unpolarized, or non-collinear spin. I can do isolated molecules and extended crystals. I have some QMM coupling where you have a force field for an environment and quantum mechanics for the local parts. You can do activation energies. You have something like crystal overlap orbital populations, which tell you sort of like the local density of states. If you take the density of states matrix as a matrix between orbitals, you can make.
This is for the chemists.
This is for the chemists, yeah. It's also useful for physicists from time to time. Actually, I learned this from Ole. Ole is the person who does this, who knows most about that, more than most chemists, right? Okay. General K points, that's also something we got recently, variable occupations. Of course, they're driven by a finite temperature formalism. Cell shape, the LDA plus U of Mebarek, the GW of Mebarek. The whole thing is object oriented, so if you have 130,000 lines, even I can't remember every line. So basically, everything is cut into pieces, rather independent sort of agents, right, with a well defined interface. So you can change, for example, one of these objects. And you're bound that it works with all the rest if you have just preserved the functionality, which allows you to, for example, make very simple changes, right? It's also very simple to code with this because you have an interface that is just easy to use, right? So if you talk about plane waves, you say, now I want to make a Fourier transform, you say plane wave, Fourier transform me that, right? And so that's rather simple. Same thing for MPI. I mean, the whole thing is parallel. It's written in Fortran 90 and is now running under most architectures. This program has been the best test for Fortran 90 compilers. In the beginning there was only one or two, and now we have quite a few that are working nicely. But even a year ago we found a bug, a real compiler bug in the UPSOFT compiler.
IBM also.
Also in IBM. I mean, they had the first one for a Fortran 90 compiler that was working, and then they changed the architecture and they built errors inside. Okay, anyway, it's rather portable now. It's very easy to install. I mean, I have a student who really wrote nice configurations of scripts and so on.
Sorry, what can you do the parallelization?
No, this is done actually with the G vectors. So I've in real space, and this is also something for this afternoon. So in real space, I make slices, and each slice comes on a processor. In reciprocal space, this is of course smaller, then I have little channels on each one. So basically right, and they are just organized in a proper way. Good. Okay.
What about relativistic effects?
Scalar relativistic is automatically included. We're just working now in including the spin orbit coupling also, especially for the non-collinear version, that's not yet working. But scalar relativistic is just standard. You have to do something to switch it off. Okay, and with this, I'm done. You find information here. This is apparently a little hard to read. If you go to my web page, you will find an article written.
Your web page is actually very difficult to find.
Why is that? Well, you just type in Blechler in Google.
To IBM, and then IBM doesn't tell you anything about.
Yeah.
Okay. So can you give us the address?
Oh, sure.
Google doesn't really know so well.
No, Google, if you look for Blechler, or for POW even, then it gets you my page.
Now there are some companies which, if you pay them some money, they will tell you how you want to put your web so that Google finds it quickly.
Okay.
Some research journal. They charge you some money.
They charge you.
You know. No. They offered me, I said no.
Oh, I see.
I don't want people to find me.
Okay, if you're interested in the code, I mean, I usually, if I want that people learn how to use it, but in principle, I tried, now that I've developed everything so far, I try to make it more open. So if one of you guys wants to use it, it's owned by IBM officially, so we have to write a letter to IBM to get a license, but then you can get the code from me, if you're interested, yeah?
So we reconvene this afternoon for some further discussions. And what's that? 8:30?
Do you have some? Yeah, sure, sure.
Okay.
Do you have some? Oh, great. Do we have any special requests that I should prepare? If you have special questions or something, then I can.
Well, I think
the construction of Pintita.
Of what?
Of the projector?
Yeah, I think we had a lot of questions.
See the dark side of BAW, maybe.
The dark side? You don't want to see it. Oh, I can give you a little demo, right? I can show you how to run it on my laptop.
Oh, right.
I think actually you want to test.
Okay.
Okay.
Very good.
Okay, anything? I need an operator from you.